Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, August 27th, 2006, and this is show number 58. That's been a really hectic week for me at work. I'm pretty good at handling, you know, a double booked time slot, but this week I was triple booked for meetings two different days. One of those days I was supposed to be at Kyle's high school registration and two other meetings, and my husband was stuck in a bunch of meetings. So I blew off work and went with Kyle to school. That seemed like a good choice to me. Speaking of my idiot son, he went to Six Flags this week and lost his phone on some ride he called Tatsu. I'm a big roller coaster hound, so I figure it was probably worth it. But that meant we had to go out and get him a new phone and head over to the wonderful experience of the Verizon store. Of course, this was mid-cycle on the two-year indentured servitude Verizon makes you sign up for, so there was very little in terms of, you know, subsidies to cut the price, so it ended up costing me a fortune. That was nice. I did opt, voluntarily, for a cooler phone than he was willing to settle for, well, because, you know, I mean, it was a gadget and everything. But the reason I picked this one was because it had a micro SD slot, so you could put music onto your phone and play MP3s. I really wanted to do this and buy him this one because I wanted to see what a micro SD card looked like. I'd seen SD cards before, and even mini SD cards, but what was a micro SD? Well, we headed over to Circuit City and bought a 256 meg card for $25, and looking at the case, it looked like a regular SD card. So before I bought it, I asked the lady about that, and she said, no, you're looking at the adapter for the card that allows you to actually put it in a memory card reader. The micro SD card is that little tiny thing you can barely see to the left of the SD adapter. This thing is small. I took a picture of it because I wasn't sure you'd believe me on how little it is. This darn thing is maybe almost a centimeter across. In the picture, I have it sitting on the end of Kyle's thumb. In order to get close enough up to it, I had to do a super macro that shows his actual fingerprints. Anyway, check out the picture in the show notes. We should probably kick into gear here now and get to work. Listener Michael heard me talking last week about how I wish I could start a spotlight search in OS X from the part where you can define some filters to your search. Like, I wanted to be able to start where I could say, file name contains something. Well, he says just hit Command F when you're in the Finder. It turns out that takes you right to exactly where I wanted. Who would have thought? Command F is only the standard find command in all Macintosh applications. Thanks, Michael. I've started using that already. That's a big help. Last week, I did a review of a shareware product called Desk Lamp for OS X Spotlight Searching Enhancement. While there were some truly cool capabilities, especially the way it found and displayed search terms inside Apple Mail, I had a lot of problems with it crashing, so I gave it pretty much a thumbs down in terms of stability. One of the things I usually do after I review a product is I let the developers know that I reviewed their tool. But I kind of hesitate when I give a bad review. I mean, that seems kind of mean to go, hi, I reviewed your tool. I hated it. But I decided to write to Alf Watt, the developer of Desk Lamp, anyway, and let him know because I thought it was a pretty promising tool. He wrote back to me within a few hours asking me for my crash logs and more information on what happened. I think this is awesome, and it's the main reason I really like shareware and freeware. I mean, can you imagine if you had a problem with a huge commercial application like Word or iTunes? How long would it take you to get a response and someone willing to actually help you figure out what went wrong? Well, as I looked around on my disk, it turned out I didn't have any crash logs. And that got me thinking. Any crash logs for Desk Lamp, I should say. I had other crash logs. So I reinstalled Desk Lamp and I replicated some of the hangups I'd had before. When I was crashing was when I'd get it, I'd ask it to do something and it would start spinning and spinning and spinning, have the spinning pizza wheel of death and a spinning gear of death. And so I would eventually force quit. So I replicated that today and I took some screen snapshots to send to Alf to show him how it got hung, including the force quit window showing that Desk Lamp was not responding. Well, while doing this and writing it all up for him, I left it spinning pizza wheel of deathing over there, and I was typing away, and then I realized the Desk Lamp did come back. So I'm thinking maybe it never crashed at all before, it just took a really long time to respond, like a minute or two. That's not as bad as a crash, but certainly not what Alf probably had in mind, I'm sure. In any case, I sent all that over to him, and I look forward to new developments on this cool little app in the future. Alf has promised that he'll keep us up to date on things as the product advances. Thanks a lot, Alf. Listener Tim reminded me to remind you, last week on the Views from the Coop show, or 2 weeks ago, I actually said that you don't need to run antivirus on a Macintosh. But in the same kind of vein, I was also talking about running Windows on my Mac. And he said, make sure I should remind you that if you are running Windows on your Mac, you do need protection. You have to run Windows Update religiously. You have to get a good antivirus and keep the definitions up to date. You need to get several anti-spyware programs, anti-adware programs, and run them religiously as well. You got to make sure you use Firefox, don't use Internet Explorer, all the things you have to do with Windows, because it's a real Windows installation. What I should have said was that you don't have to run any antivirus, spyware, or adware software on OS X. Yet. Thanks for reminding me to be more clear in the future, Tim. Listener James Coxis really knows the key to my heart. He wrote me a completely insulting email that made me laugh and then followed it up with a fantastic tutorial for all of us. Let me read you his email first. Here's how it starts. Hey, woman. Oh, great. That's how my snotty 15-year-old son addresses me. He says, I sent this to your podfeed.com account, but it got kicked back, so I'm trying again with your Gmail account as a backup. Anyway, on to the original message. Can I submit a tutorial to your tutorial section of the site? Didn't know if it was off limits to us mere mortals. It's a great lesson on how to create keyboard shortcuts for Automator actions. I've attached an HTML file. It references images on my server so you don't have to worry about bandwidth when millions of people flock to it. Unless, of course, millions of people really do flock to it, my sarcasm turns into a nightmarish reality for you. After all, the tutorial section is how I stumbled upon your train wreck of a podcast in the first place. Did I say train wreck? Oh, sorry. I meant to say sorry excuse for. On another note, great job on Views from the Coop. Listening to you guys go back and forth was comparable to sprinting, then crawling, sprinting, then crawling. It was a really funny dynamic that you guys had going on. It was amazing how quickly you were able to convert that one chick, a term I don't normally use, to buy a Mac in a matter of minutes. I'm going to start listening to that show just to see your husband's reaction. It seems like everyone here at work is seriously thinking about getting a Mac as their next computer. Crazy, especially since we create Windows-only applications. I've been on the Mac since the beginning and can honestly say that this is the most exciting time to be a Mac user. Keep up the great work on the show, and thanks a million. Your humble servant, James Coxis, graphic designer. All right, even though James is clearly a pest, I have to grudgingly admit that his tutorial is brilliant. Before I get into that, I do want to point out that I don't think I single-handedly convinced Christy of Views from the Coop to switch to a Mac. I think I may have removed any final doubts she had about whether it was a good idea. She was balanced on the edge already, just needed one more vote in that direction, I suspect. Let's get on to James' tutorial. As I mentioned last week, I haven't a clue how to use Automator, which is a built-in scripting tool in Mac OS X. The main barrier to learning it was that I couldn't figure out where it could help me. With James' excellent instructions using a real-life example where it could actually help, I think I might get the hang of this. Let's walk through James' tutorial, and remember, just like everything else I talk about, the instructions are all in the show notes, including some nice screenshots James provided. Those are the ones millions of people are going to flock to. This is good enough that I will also post this in my permanent tutorial section in the sidebar on podfeet.com. I should mention that I edited step 2, which will walk us through how to assign the keyboard shortcuts using a tool called Shortcuts. I got hung up during this part, so I added a few extra instructions to help you out. My picture isn't as elegant as his screen snapshots, but the step is important. So let's dig in and learn some Automator. At this point, I'm going to be reading directly from his instructions, but they're really good. Ever want to create a keyboard shortcut for tasks you do multiple times a day? Here's a really simple way to do it. I use a combination of Automator and a utility called Shortcuts from abracode.com/free/CMWorkshop. Shortcuts allow you to create keyboard shortcuts for contextual menu items in the Finder. And with Automator, you can add actions to that contextual menu. Boy, it's a hard word to say, contextual. In this example, we'll create a keyboard shortcut that will attach a selected file to a new mail message. That's something we all like to do all the time. This will eliminate the need to drag the file onto the mail icon in the dock, or, God forbid, attach the document via a dialog box. Other uses can be quick upload of a file using Transmit, opening selected files, specific applications, instead of having to right-click and wait for a list of apps to show up, or testing web pages in multiple browsers instead of opening the file in each browser manually. I use this with tons of workflows. It makes life bearable. In fact, between this and Quicksilver, I was able to completely clear off my dock, except for the trash and Finder. Another reason to love the Mac. Don't worry, this shouldn't be too advanced. I do have to say, this was not too advanced, and again, when doing this was the very, very first time I ever used Automator. So if I can do it, you can do it. So, step one, we're going to create an Automator action to attach the selected file to a new mail message. All you have to do is launch Automator, and under the Library column, click on Finder. Under the Action column, drag Open Finder Items over to the Workflow pane on the right-hand side. Then you select Mail from the drop-down menu. So all we've done is told the action to open Finder Items and select Mail. From the File menu, then you need to choose Save As Plugin. Now this was kind of an interesting thing. This makes this action is actually a plugin to the Finder, which is kind of not intuitive to me, but I'm keeping up so far. So then give it a name like Attach File to Mail Message and leave the plugin menu set to Finder. Quit Automator. So now what we've done is we've created an action that attaches the image to an email. But now what we really want to do is also have a keyboard shortcut to make that action go. So we're going to launch the program called Shortcuts. We're going to click the Setup tab. Here's the step that he didn't give us. Click the three buttons labeled Start, Add, and Install. This will start the Shortcut Observer, so your shortcut will work in this session. Add the Shortcut Observer to your login startup items, so your shortcut will work every time you log in. And install the Cocoa Text Selection Helper, which evidently assists in text selection. I don't know what it really does. Next, click the Assign Hotkeys tab. Under the File section, select the action you just created from the pull-down menu. It's going to be in the Automator flyout menu on the right-hand side. So you're just going to assign a key, and you're going to tell it what you're going to assign it to. A sheet will drop down asking you to type in the keyboard shortcut you'd like to use. Type in the key combo. Make sure it doesn't conflict with any other key combos in the Finder. Click Assign and quit Shortcuts. That's literally the whole thing. All you've done is launching shortcuts, giving it a name, you know, what you're going to do, click the buttons, and you're done. So step three is to test it. Go to the Finder, highlight a file, hit the keyboard shortcut you created. Watch as mail launches and attaches your file to a new message. Pat yourself on the back. You now rock as hard as me. Congratulations and good luck. If you have any problems, email me at james@jamescoxis.com. That's jamescoxis.com. He also says, thanks for hosting this tutorial, Allison. You are a true goddess. Oh, he thinks he's going to redeem himself after that train wreck of a podcast crack. We'll see. Anyway, thank you, James, for teaching me this, and I think I'll get over my fear from Automator now and really dig in and give it some exercise. Listener Will left a comment on the blog over at podfeet.com, and he suggested yet another Web 2.0 homepage thingy. You know, we've been reviewing a bunch of those lately. He says, hey, Allison, love the podcast. I just wanted to add to your list of Web 2.0 homepages. I've tried almost all. GUI, Protopage, PageFlakes, Google IG, Windows Live, and Yahoo, and the best of all is NetVibes. Take a look. He put a link in to netvibes.com. He also asked, although I'm not a Mac expert, only a novice, but can you use Automator to create a name-contained search from Spotlight? Not sure where Will got the idea that I have a clue how to use Automator. Good thing James came along to get us all started, right? I gave it a try to assign a name-contained search from Spotlight using Automator, and I was able to get this thing to pop up when I hit my shortcut that shows a pull-down for where I want to search and defaults to name contains, and I can type something in the search term. The only problem is when I tell it to do the search, it goes off and does something, and then I see in the top menu bar a message saying the action is complete, and then it turned into a spinning gear that said the name of my automator action, and it wouldn't stop. I finally quit all my applications with plans to log out and back in again, when under everything was a little window that had been launched by my shortcut and I didn't realize it. Pretty clear I still need a bit more experience before I start telling people how to do this. And it's a good thing listener Michael sent in the tip about Command F that does exactly what I wanted. On to Will's other idea. He suggested we check out netvibes.com. Graphically, it looks a lot like Bitacle, the one I reviewed last week, with a pleasing blue color for each of the sections. The first thing I did was tailor the Gmail window for my account, and it pulled all of my emails, unlike Bitacle, which would not connect. However, when I click on the emails, it brings up a big banner for Google Chat, and then asks me if I want to log into my Gmail account. I did it, and while it didn't launch Google Chat, which was a relief, I think it was just an ad for Google Chat, it took me into my email. Well, that wasn't much of a benefit there. The double login doesn't make sense. I could have just logged Gmail myself. One of the pre-stock sections, they're not calling them bits or flakes, not sure what I should call them, but I'll go with sections, is a web search window that's excellent. It has little tabs for Google, Yahoo, IceRocket, and Wikipedia. Not sure what IceRocket is, but I'm sure I'm going to use it now. It's nice to have them all right there, easy to switch between them. Deleting sections you've added, or that they added, is a snap, but it does ask you to confirm, which seems unnecessary because they're so easy to put back. I did quickly figure out that a quick carriage return got rid of the warning, so it wasn't all that annoying. All right, time to add more content. When I added a new section, it drew a red box around where I was placing it before I let go. I thought that was kind of nice. You can tell what's going to happen before you commit. On the top banner of each section, there are icons for several things that show up when you hover over it, like publish on NetVibe ecosystem, refresh, edit, and close, along with the name of the section and a number if it's an RSS or email listing. Well, all those little things are kind of handy, but it caused a problem when my window was narrowed because there was no free space left in the title bar of the section for me to be able to grab it and move it around. I kept getting it to pop up and asking me if I wanted to add it to the ecosystem or whether I wanted to publish it to another website and all kinds of stuff when I really just wanted to move it around. I got distracted after I added the Flickr photos section. It's a category they call everyone's favorite tagged photos. So cool. The pictures were awesome. I was looking at all these pictures. I was having all this fun. Oh, wait. I was supposed to be in the middle of doing a review. Back to work. As you hover over each new content choice, a nice little box flips up to tell you about that particular item. So you can go down all the items on the left-hand side that they ask you to, you can choose from, and see what each one is about. They have tons of things you can add, from box.net to Fox Sport Video, to iCal Viewer, to eBay. The list goes on and on. Wait a minute. I get distracted again because they had AOL Radio, which I've talked about before, but this one takes you to music videos, and the first one listed was John Mayer. I'm a sucker for John Mayer, and I found myself over on music.aol.com watching him sing. I really think AOL is reinventing itself so well with this line of music distribution. This was pretty cool. But wait, wasn't I supposed to be doing a review of NetVibes? Back to work. I created a new tab by hitting new tab, and it let me rename it. I called it Mail and Stuff, and I wondered if I could just drag my Gmail onto that tab, and it would automatically move it from the first tab to the second tab, and it did it perfectly. Very nice. They also let you name the homepage, your first tab if you like, and you can name the page itself up at the top. I really like the way they integrated RSS feeds in. I was able to add the NoSilicast feed, of course, and it gave me a short listing of the feeds, maybe, I don't know, 5 or 7 of the most recent items. And if I click on one of them, it brought up another window inside that page, not a new browser window. And it showed me all of them with the RSS text to the right if I clicked on them. It even had a listen button, which got me all excited. But then when I clicked it, nothing happened, so my thrill was short-lived. I wonder why it didn't do anything. Might have been a pop-up blocker or something, not sure. The download button didn't actually download either, but it did bring up the audio file inside my browser in QuickTime. The feed directory was pretty big, especially in the science and tech category. That was a complaint I had about Bitticle, not a lot of content in there. The feed interface is very pleasing to the eye and intuitive. Uh-oh, I get distracted again. I stumbled across a Flickr memory site in the feed directory and saw some gorgeous shots of New York City at night. These are highly Photoshopped photos, but they're really cool. I put a link in the show notes because I had so much fun on it. Well, based on how many times I wandered off task and started playing in NetVibes, I'd say that Will has given us a great suggestion for a nice Web 2.0 page. Much better than Bitticle and even stable. Thanks for the suggestion, Will. I think I'll play around with that one for a while. My niece Sarah always has cool suggestions for me. In fact, she was the one that first pointed me to Pandora a long time ago before everybody knew about it. And she's come up with another interesting site. Let's say there's a musician or a music group you really like, and you wish they had a podcast. What if you could find everyone who's playing anything by those artists on the web and make it into a podcast? Enter Hype Machine from Hype, that's H-Y-P-E, non-standard.net. Hype Machine's FAQ says, the Hype Machine is an experiment, emphasis on experiment, that keeps track of songs and discussions posted on the best blogs about music. They track a variety of MP3 blogs, and if a post contains MP3 links, it adds those links to a database. I tested out Hype Machine by typing in John Mayer, and I was shown a list of blogs that all had MP3s by John Mayer. I could click on Listen, which brought up a little flash player, and just play the music, or I could click on Winamp, WinMedia, or RealPlayer players. But the real magic is that there's a button called Podcast. I clicked on that, told Firefox to open the PCast file it created with iTunes, and suddenly I'm downloading a podcast titled The Hype Machine Search Results for John and Mayer. Now here's the scary thing. The so-called podcast episodes are not people talking about John Mayer. They're high-quality MP3 files of his songs. One was 128 kilobytes per second, and the next one was 192K, all in stereo. So that got me thinking, how is this not stealing his music? On the Hype Machine website, there's a disclaimer that says, if you are an artist or represent an artist and are concerned about tracks appearing in our listings, you can find more information here and are welcome to contact us directly. I clicked on the Find More Information link and read their copyright notice. They said that they support and respect the artists, writers, and editors and producers who create original content, and that they encourage users to enjoy legitimate downloadable media and to purchase music after sampling it online. Then they go on to explain how they collect the material and that they give full links to those who post material they collect, including the authors of all postings, which I guess is their way of saying, if you have a problem, contact them. But they do also encourage anyone who feels their copyrights have been compromised to contact them and they'll remove the link to that site. This all sounds good, and I'm not a lawyer, but it seems that when they go beyond just letting you listen online and let you download high-quality audio recordings, it's got to be stealing. I do believe that it probably stimulates music in an artist to be able to do that, but I can't quite figure out who would be motivated to buy the song on iTunes, on the iTunes Music Store, if they already have a downloaded version of it in their iTunes that sounds really good. I'd be curious to know what you think of this. Am I off base here? Am I missing something? Or is this really stealing? Hype Machine did get my curiosity up on this PCast file format it had. I found out that if you have a podcast you like, drag it from iTunes to your desktop and it creates a PCast file. You can now email or IM that file to someone and they drag it into their iTunes and then they're subscribed. It's a pretty cool trick. No idea how long that's been around, but it's pretty handy. Now you can email all your friends your NoSilicast PCast file so everyone can be happy. Well, I hope no one thinks this next website is in poor taste. It's called kittenwar.com. It's not for everyone. I got to put a lot of disclaimers around this, but I really think you should go check it out. All right, I just decided to try and make you worry and make it sound bad. It's actually a website where you vote on which kittens are the cutest. People upload their kitten pictures, and then people set up battles between them in pairs. You can vote yourself, and you can also view the most winningest kittens to see these adorable little blobs of fluff. Well, that's mildly entertaining if you like adorable, fluffy little love balls, but the part I like best was the losingest kittens. Good gracious, there are some ugly kittens out there in the world. Head on over to kittenwar.com for a good giggle on the ugly ones or a warm, fuzzy feeling on the cute ones. Last week, I showed how to do a batch shrink of photos using iPhoto on the Mac, so you don't have to wait forever to upload your photos to MySpace or to email them when people really want a smaller version. I promised I'd show a solution for Windows, so I installed the free Picasa software from Google. If you haven't already installed Picasa on your Windows machine, you really should check it out. It's awesome. I did a full review in show number 24 back in January of 2006 if you want to hear all about it. I figure if there's a good program for shrinking photos, Picasa would be it. When I installed Picasa, I found one really interesting thing. You know how when you're done installing software on Windows and the installer asks, is it okay to put a shortcut on the desktop? Can I put one in the start menu? Can I put one in the taskbar? Can I put one in your kitchen sink? Well, when Picasa gets to this point, it helpfully asks, is it okay to change your search engine in Internet Explorer to Google? Not too obvious that Picasa is from Google, is it? Anyway, once I got Picasa installed, I let it scan my computer for photos. I found that there's two ways to shrink photos as promised. One is to email them out, and you can set the preferences in there to shrink them appropriately, or what we're really looking for, which is to shrink them and send to a new folder. Picasa didn't have exactly what I was hoping for. I was looking for the ability to control the physical dimensions and the resolution in dots per inch. Instead, they have a menu pick under File called Export, where you can choose to resize to a specific number of pixels. I think that's kind of a weird way of looking at it. I don't know how many pixels are in a photo unless I sit down and do math. They do have a slider for it, and you can change the JPEG image quality too. If anyone has a cool batch method of changing resolution that's better than this, please drop me a line. I'd like to help the Windows users to be able to do what I already know how to do on the Mac. I really thought Picasa would be the best way, but I'm betting someone out there actually knows a really good way to shrink up a photo to post online. I heard on Leo Laporte's radio show in Los Angeles that he uses a really cool open source tool to improve his productivity. He has a Mac and a PC sitting side by side with one monitor each, and he has one keyboard and mouse in the middle of those two monitors, and he uses it to control both computers. The software on each computer is called Synergy, and it allows him to seamlessly move his mouse between the two computers, and control shifts automatically back and forth between them. He's even able to select something in Windows, Control C to copy it from there, slide his mouse over to the Mac side, and hit a Command V to paste over there. Pretty cool. This sounded like something I had to play with. Synergy is available from synergy2.sourceforge.net. I downloaded it onto my son's Mac and on his Windows PC, and for the life of me, I could not figure out how to get this thing to run. Believe it or not, the easy side was Windows. There's a nice little installer that created an application I could open and then configure. Not sure what I was doing in the configuration, but at least there was a GUI interface and I pushed some buttons and I typed some stuff in. On the Mac side, they did the whole thing in Unix. So instead of a little GUI interface, they were blathering on about path names and telling me to type in commands like synergy space dash f space dash dash config space synergy.conf. And creating text files and all kinds of crazy geek stuff. I played around until I could successfully launch the program from the command line and get it to spit back the very helpful configuration file not found message, and I decided to go outside and play. For those of you with a higher geekness than me, enjoy Synergy, and I'll be at the beach. Well, that sounds like a good place to wind up this episode of the No Silicast. This has been a great week for listener feedback. I love that. So keep up the good work. Keep me honest, and send me a note at allison@podfeet.com or drop me a voice recording at nosilicast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.